Show Me the Way, episode 36, The Succession Coach. In this episode, we will talk with Teresa Carey about her experiences in assisting individuals and their businesses in dealing with growth and succession planning. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to hang around because we've got some golden nuggets in the middle of the podcast that we planted and some extremely insightful ones at the end. So you'll want to hear the entire podcast. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP, about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. So, ladies and gentlemen, today, this is the main version. I am going forward with the podcast from the central portion of Maine out near Augusta, Maine. And I'm dialing all the way back to Kansas City. So I'm going from the cold climes of Maine back to the heat of Kansas City to interview Teresa. For transparency purposes, which is a great 21st century word, it's important that you know that Teresa has been my coach and has helped me during a very, very significant growth spurt in my practice. But before I ever hired her to help me, I knew that she had been working with many successful and significant CEOs in the Midwest. And because of that, I called upon her to help me with my business and life goals. We're going to go way beyond that in our conversation today, but I wanted to give you a little background. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Dave, thank you. It's such a joy to be here with you today.
Let's get a little bit of a flavor of your background and your early life experiences. And I do not believe, because she would always talk about this, I do not believe I know how to spell or pronounce the word Yadkin properly. So will you start there with us and why that word is significant to you?
Absolutely. I appreciate you asking that because I do think it was a very formative part of who I am today. But to clarify, Dave, it's Yadkin County, North Carolina. And for anyone who would recognize Mayberry based on generational relevance, I would just refer to Andy and Barney, but both sets of my grandparents were farmers. And I grew up working on the farm from a very young age. That gave me an opportunity to develop a super strong work ethic at a young age. And I think I've carried that throughout my life and my career. The adventure really began, though, when my dad bought my great-grandmother's farm. And so my brother and I took a major part in running the farm through high school. I would even classify this as my first entrepreneurial experience. And it was okay at the time, even though I didn't really like the work, but it was my ticket to buying my first car. It made sure I got my undergraduate education paid for. So looking back, I wouldn't trade the experience and what it taught me.
So there's farming in the Midwest and there's farming in North Carolina. What does farming in North Carolina look like? And Yadkin County is up, am I right, northwest corner of the state, up near the Blue Ridge Mountains. Am I thinking the right way?
It's actually in the Piedmont.
Piedmont.
It's about 30 miles west of Winston-Salem and about 70 miles north of Charlotte.
Farming in that part of the world.
Yeah, farming in that part of the world meant tobacco.
Yes.
There was some corn, some soybeans, but nothing like in the Midwest. But my grandparents raised cattle and they raised tobacco. That was the cash crop at that time. And what's been interesting is the landscape has changed in that, you know, there aren't the same subsidies and things that there were back in the 70s, the 60s, 70s, 80s. Around tobacco. So now a lot of that land, because it's poised on the Yadkin River, is allocated for growing grapes. And there are several wineries there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I did not know that. Interesting. So let's fast forward. How did you get from Yadkin County to Kansas City? Give us the transition that you went through.
All right. Well, you know, I had quite the motivation to go from a farm field to a business building. And so I earned an undergraduate degree at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. I got a BS in business. And then I also obtained a master's degree at Kansas State University. But that came later after I had some business experience under my belt. I started with a company who's a document technology company out of the Chicago area, but I went to work for them in sales in Charlotte, North Carolina, right out of undergrad school. And then they brought me into the corporate office to be a part of training and development. And that was based on my sales success. So I went from that position then to Kansas City. So Charlotte to Chicago, and then to Kansas City to lead a sales office here. And that's the point at which I decided, after helping with a turnaround and generating increased sales in that office for a couple of years, that I would go back to school and start my own business around my first love, which is training, developing, and coaching others. And it was interesting because while I was in that training and development role, we had a coaching process. And at that time, there weren't a lot of organizations who were engaged in coaching their leaders, but we had a coaching program for all the field sales team of about 1,000, along with the leaders, and I helped execute on that.
Fantastic. And so that business was originally, or was created to be, what is now the name of your company, which is?
Performance Point. Performance and Incorporated.
And how long have you been engaged in business with Performance Point?
For these past 29 years, we just reached our 29-year milestone in June.
Wow.
And so I'm really proud of that. You know, you had asked me at one point, what are some of your accomplishments? I think we had a conversation recently around that. And, you know, I would tell you my greatest accomplishment in executive coaching and coaching leaders who are going through transition is the work and the change and unleashing the potential in them. As an executive coach, we don't get a lot of tangible rewards. You know, we're not really the sage on the stage, we're the guide on the side.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay. We'll have to, that one's going to have to be written down and put in with the notes for this podcast. That's a good one. Share with us a little bit about the transition you made in your coaching career to get to the point now where you become a specialist in helping companies start rapid growth.
So Dave, I started in training and development and then quickly realized that the market was going to be demanding proof that their training, their development dollars were working. And so I approached one of the organizations I was doing work with, one of my clients, and presented the idea to them. And they weren't really excited about it like I was. And so I developed a proprietary tool and a model that allows us to measure and mark progress. And so I transitioned from training and development early on into coaching, was running a couple of tracks. One was leadership and executive development. The other one was career strategy for executives. And about 14 years ago, decided to just focus on executive leadership development, specifically for leaders who are owners of companies, usually first gen, not always, but typically first gen companies and their teams, to help them navigate pre-rapid growth. And we defined that based on looking at the Harvard life cycle of businesses. And there was a big gap that wasn't represented between late growth and rapid growth, because there's a big bridge and a transition that typically has to occur. Leaders have to be equipped very differently as they move from being functional leaders into institutional and enterprise-wide leaders. So we made that leap and haven't looked back. That was about 14 years ago. And that's our sweet spot and our micro niche today.
Well, you said something interesting too to go with that. You made some proprietary product. Did I understand that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a software or a test, or what does that look like?
No, it's actually a map, a roadmap for the coaching process. And it helps us define what we'll be working on and how we're going to measure what we're working on.
Excellent.
So that we're able to report progress to the client.
Teresa, you've coached your customers that in order to lead business to a successful exit, your leadership team must develop and be primed for growth and substantial transition and into potentially acquisition, or for that matter, scaling down of a business. The value you've indicated to me over the years is your top talent and keeping them in place, as they are the key component of, I don't want to use the word perceived, but the real component of value for any business. How have you gone through helping folks with this objective? And maybe you could give us some examples or analogies, maybe you got a couple of stories.
Sure. Well, Dave, I think this can best be started by sharing an example of the Summer Olympics. You know, there's an event that's probably one of the most watched, most enjoyed events, and it's the 4x100 relay. And what's interesting is that event was started in 1912, and the U.S. dominated that particular event throughout the 20th century. In the 21st century, the U.S. has not earned one gold medal.
I didn't know that. Wow.
There's one reason for that. You want to guess what it is?
Individuality?
Bad handoffs.
Yeah.
So each well-synchronized handoff in a relay race results in each runner having about a 3-second mark difference in their timing, which in a 4x100 race, that's significant, right?
Yes.
If we're going to get 10 to 12 more seconds. So whether an owner is handing off the business, whether they're selling a business, or one leader is preparing for the next leader to come in, maybe the CEO, but maybe someone else in the C-suite, the handoff can be significant in that situation. So we work with teams of leaders. Typically, you were an exception, but usually we work with teams of leaders in companies who are headed toward that inflection point that I just alluded to earlier, between pre-rapid growth, and that's defined usually as growth year over year, typically in the double digits for 3 to 5 years. And they're headed toward this hyper-growth trajectory. And this trajectory will usually take them to some sort of exit. So think, for example, maybe the software company.
Right.
They're acquired by the nation's largest within their sector. Or maybe it's the firm who's ripe for a private equity infusion needed to fuel the growth. And then maybe they'll be sold in 3 to 5 years. Or maybe they'll go public, right? That's another scenario. Maybe it's the firm that's just been acquired recently by the private equity firm, and they want to invest in the leaders so that in that 3 to 5 year time horizon, they get the greatest ROI on that investment. So, you know, growth isn't just about having a great product or service or being in the right place at the right time in the market. It takes talent, right? And it means creating a team of leaders, and this is really important in the pre-rapid to rapid growth piece, creating a group of leaders that go from being functional leaders to enterprise leaders in the organization. So for this to happen, what we do is we assess the strengths of each leader. We look at blind spots. We come up with a collective set of competencies that will be important to that organization for the growth, and then we lead them through a coaching process. And it's been my experience that talent is typically a key part of the multiplier in the business valuation. Acquirers often look at what I call the 4 P's, people, product, profitability, and potential.
Well, you had mentioned something, I want to go back to it. Functionality to entrepreneurial, was that, you mentioned those two as different, shall we say, skill sets, and that one had to jump from being from that first vantage point to becoming an entrepreneur within the organization. Did I get that correct?
No, actually, what I hope I said,
okay,
is that they have to move from being functional leaders to enterprise-wide leaders.
Enterprise-wide leaders.
Yeah, so let's say that my genius zone is operations.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just think about my silo of operations.
Right.
That's only one piece of the equation, right? When I'm leading a rapid growth organization. I'm in the C-suite. I've got to think broadly. Think broadly and strategically. Act broadly and strategically.
Right. That's perfect. That makes a ton of sense. I find sometimes, too, I get functionality to enterprise or looking at it from your what I call the narrow ship channel that you're in to overall the direction of the company. So what do you do when you run across someone maybe is really great in a functional role, but won't make the jump or doesn't have the ability, what I call the unique ability to jump to the enterprise viewpoint that they ought to be taking with the company?
Well, that's where coaching comes into play. We stretch that muscle a lot.
Very good.
Yeah. You know, I didn't swim, bike, or run until I was 46, Dave, but right. I learned how to do it.
She was a triathlete, or still is probably.
People can be taught.
Very good. Let's talk about what kills succession planning beyond just the handoff. What are the other difficulties that you have to, that you see and you have to deal with?
Yeah, well, one thing, especially if it's a first-gen business, is control.
Right.
You know, they become successful because they are astute at entrepreneurship. Typically, they're technically savvy or they have experience in the product or service that the business is based on. And so sometimes giving up control is hard. And typically, they're reluctant because they're fearful.
Right.
The stakes are really high when you get to that pre-rapid and rapid growth phase. So often there's over control, over immersion. That can kill effective succession planning. Another one can be when there's more of a self-interest versus an institutional interest. I don't see that a lot in the CEO because it's their baby.
Right.
So they're going to be focused more on the institution. Sometimes the ego can bump into that. But usually they move through that because they're accountable. But sometimes in the C-suite, you know, you might see a leader who gets a little caught up on individual interest. Another one might be a lack of proactive planning. And in my world, that would typically be represented by a lack of planning in identifying high potential or high performing leaders who are needed, desperately needed to feed and build the talent pipeline. Right. We don't want to have a shallow bench because any number of things can happen and we need to be building and moving people into the pipeline, which is where the next point comes into play. And that's not allocating the resources and the talent strategies to develop those leaders. I love what Bill Campbell, who was the former CEO of Intuit, had to say about that. He said, really, you need a leadership factory. You know, it's not enough to make the widgets. Mm-hmm. You're in the business of making leaders as well.
So, Teresa, a few more, shall we say, examples that maybe you can call upon. Let's start with this one. What are the attributes that make succession planning work?
Well, I would refer to these as the big five. Dave, this list is not exhausted by any means. Mm-hmm. But these are five of some of the most common themes that I would see. One is creating a process and trusting it. It doesn't mean that you can't be nimble when new information enters, but you know, the prototypical entrepreneur sees a shiny object and sees an opportunity. And so just to resist that temptation and to stay focused and intentional. Another one is clarity. I typically help bring this out with leaders, sometimes in a group, by helping create a strategy process map. And that's where they can define timeline, goals, milestones. Another one is a piece we've already talked about, which is being proactive, making sure that leaders are proactively planning. Another one is resourcefulness, realizing what you can and can't do, what you're good at, what you're not good at, and tapping those resources, which is a close cousin to the fifth area, which is humility. I'll give you a good example of that when we work with the CEO of a 75-year-old company. And you might say, what? Pre-rapid and rapid growth. It's right. Because he has reintroduced such amazing innovation into that business. And he's the visionary. You know, he's the deal maker. And he was trying to wear the hat of CEO and president. And it became very clear to both of us, he was going to need to tap a president, someone who could help with the day-to-day, someone who could help with the leader oversight and the leader development. And so he did that. He hired someone from within. And that's where the plot thickens. You know, the fact that he's a third-gen leader driving innovation in a mature industry through things like AI and other avenues. But wait, there's more. When he tapped this new president, she was the very first non-family member in a top role. Yeah, so he had the humility and the insight to realize what he didn't know and where he needed help.
It's so tough, too. I mean, I say that even to myself, that if you can look at it with greater humility, you tend to see more about life and yourself, those around you, and your business. And it gives you a better, for lack of a better term, better vision on what things are really all about. What are the biggest lessons you would share with the successor?
Yeah, I would say this would apply to the successor or the owner. And one would be the Ewing Kauffman principle. You know, the Kansas City legend, for those who may not know who are listening, who invented Marion Labs. It was acquired by Dow Chemical. It's gone through several iterations since then, but he was the legend who really put a strong foothold and a great footprint, I should say, on Kansas City in the entrepreneurial area. Also, Kauffman Stadium, you know, where our team plays baseball, is named after him. And he always said, hire people who are smarter than you.
Right.
If you're the smartest person in the room, then you're in the wrong room. Or you're surrounding yourself with the wrong people. One of those two. I think another one, especially, and I'm going to take this back to the owner and then we'll talk about the success. But for the owner, I think it's something I have also talked about, which is know your purpose and your values, because together, these really function as your North Star. They will guide you throughout the whole journey, because those are the two things that are immutable amongst all the other change that you experience. Another would be to walk the talent tightrope very carefully. You know, it's a hard balance. You're growing and you're thinking, should we hire someone new? And I see some companies get into trouble because they overhire at the top in particular. And then you've got this huge number, you know, on your cash flow statement, your profit and loss statement. Well, then that's going to bleed into EBITDA, affect EBITDA, right? Which will impact valuation at the time of exit.
So yes.
Those would be three lessons that I would share with an owner. And then with the successor, just going to the other side of the table here, have a 30, 60, 90, 180-day plan. You know, Michael Watkins, in his book, The First 90 Days, takes a leader, takes a successor through the process of what they need to be listening for, what they need to be observing. And that should be the first 90 days. You're not adding a lot. You're just soaking in as much as you possibly can, so that you let people teach you who they are, basically. And after that, I would say, depending on the health of the culture, use the culture as a guideline for the speed by which you make changes. So if I'm walking into a healthy culture, people are engaged, there's not a retention problem, I'm probably going to drip changes in and not do anything urgently. If I'm walking into a culture that's completely unhealthy, then I think you act pretty quickly. We used to refer to it in OD as ripping off the Band-Aid.
Right.
As you're going to be bleeding people, bleeding revenue, and all those mission critical areas are going to be impacted. So move quickly.
What unexpectedly has shown up, the kind of the aha moments that you've experienced in succession planning?
I think some of the challenging situations I faced is when I'm brought in to coach and the leader has already been selected and their profile wasn't really right for the role that they were in. It was a mismatch. So sometimes adjustments have to be made. And that's not based on my input necessarily as much as it just manifests itself.
Right.
But I do provide, you know, some of the caveats around that. Some leaders have been selected and I've been asked to work with them, but their leadership was based on past performance. You know, being successful as a leader, right. They were charming. They were super talented. And instead of looking at what does the business need and let's find a person to fill that role,
right.
They say, oh, we found this great leader. Let's plug him or her in here. It doesn't work, right? We know the rest of the story. And then bringing leaders with experience in more mature businesses, and they didn't necessarily go into that business when the business was going through the pain of pre-rapid and rapid growth. They really don't have as much of the entrepreneurial mindset that's needed to walk into an entrepreneurial organization and walk that path. Their mindset is different. Their MO is completely different. So it doesn't work.
You know, it seems to me, I've seen this with businesses, that what got you to a certain level and the leader that got you to that level may not be the right leader for the next level. I don't know how to quantify that, but I've seen that in my own experiences with various businesses, business owners, and you feel for them.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, at the end of the day, you can find some people that were great leaders, maybe the founder of the company, but it always seems to me that you have to look at a new or, shall we say, different direction, because with each leader has their own way of looking at how the business ought to go forward, right or wrong.
Well said. Well said. And, you know, there are such great resources out there. When you said what got you here, it reminded me of one of the world's most renowned coaches, Marshall Goldsmith, and his work around two areas. One is in succession. He has a book called Succession. And the other one is What Got You Here Won't Get You There.
Right.
So for any listeners who seek out, you know, cognitive development and books on that very topic, those are two great ones. And then another one after assimilating in as a new owner or a new leader is The Next Level by Scott Ebel.
Right. You're in the business of leading people. It seems like in business, you manage systems and machinery, but you lead people. And I hear a lot of times people will use the word manage people. How do you feel about the term managing people?
Well, I think that's one of the attributes that can also make succession planning fail. You know, I would tell you, if we turn the table and looked at what makes succession planning work in terms of the attributes of leaders, one of those is proactivity. Leaders are proactive. Managers are reactive.
Right.
So anytime I'm coaching a leader, I'm going to coach them in that competency of being proactive, engaging in strategic thinking, getting off the battlefield and going up onto the balcony at least once a week. I hope they'll do it more than that. But that's what promotes proactivity, because that gives you that break, that pause for the cause, and being able to really sit back and not just look at what's happened and reflecting on that, but more importantly, think ahead to what's coming, so that you can get in front of it.
How long, and this is a very difficult question, but how long do you typically tell people it's going to take to make this transition? Or can you even do that? Is that a fair question?
Yeah. It can be timed with the company's time horizon into exit and transition, whatever that might look like. That's not always predictable. But let's just say apart from that, if we just look at what an expected performance development, coaching development time horizon is for an owner and executive team of leaders, it's at least a year. I say that, and then we have businesses and leaders that we've worked with for 12 years as they've gone through several iterations in their business.
I was going to say, as the business, you know, goes forward, slides, comes back, it seems like, oh, I remember doing this years ago, I think through Bruce Mormon at Grant Thornton. He showed me that he believed that there were seven steps to any business entity, a growth, maturity, explosion to sliding into the abyss, so to speak. So you could have, I guess, in what you do, seven steps, for lack of a better term, in trying to help businesses go forward. You know, especially in light of COVID, especially in light of 2007, 2008, and I don't want to go back as far as when you and I got out of school, which was a little bit ago. Although, ladies and gentlemen, she is perpetually young, you need to know, in all seriousness. But tell me, how do you think that what you have done in dealing with succession planning has evolved over the last 10 years? Is it the same thing? Do you look at it different? And why? And by the way, you can throw in Gen Z, millennials, and anything along those lines that might aid in answering the question.
Yeah. Well, you know, the succession planning practice within the organization typically falls within the scope of HR.
Right.
So I don't usually lead that, right? I'm working with the leaders within the context of what's been defined by the human capital folks in the organization. But I would just share two observations. And one is more companies today have talent managers who address this head on. There's actually a role that at some point along the journey is devoted to this versus 10 years ago. And then my observation too is that companies are more thoughtful about having a talent management strategy. So even if that person's not there, let's just say there's a three-person HR team, they will still be purposeful and intentional about developing a talent strategy so that they have that talent bench and that pipeline that I alluded to earlier. They just don't want to be caught without the right talent. I think partially, Dave, that's changed because of something you alluded to, you know, the pandemic and then the talent shortages that we saw. And then we had the great resignation.
Right.
So companies have learned the lesson to be prepared for succession.
It's got to be tough in trying to figure out how to help people with leadership and succession planning when you're working remotely. Has that been a difficult, or shall we say, an added complication for you in what you do with businesses?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And I think what's intriguing is 80% of coaching worldwide was done virtually before the pandemic.
Okay.
So people were accustomed. I already had Zoom set up. I had used it with other clients who were distance clients. You know, maybe their company is headquartered here, but they're based in Los Angeles or DC. And so it really wasn't a major turn for the coaching industry.
Oh, good for you. You're ahead of the curve. Where do you think your business, your industry is going in the next 10 or 20 years? If we were to cast a vision into the future, what would it look like?
Yeah, well, you know, we've seen a lot of growth in the industry year over year. I'll just give you some statistics that are reflective of coaching overall. But as I share these, I think it's important to remember some of the consistency that we're seeing in the ROI of coaching. And Metrics Global tells us that it's at least 500%. I think their number's about 526% ROI, specifically in the field of executive and leadership coaching. If we look at the whole coaching market, 2022 numbers in the US tell us that it's going to continue to grow at about 5.4% annually. And while the industry right now is worth about, 1.4 billion, by 2030 is projected to be at about 2.1 billion.
Wow. So this is going to be a dynamic business for the rest of the time you're on this earth, helping people and coaching them to be the best that they can be and that their companies can excel in all respects. How about a couple of nuggets to leave the listeners with? Do you have two or three pieces of advice that you might get people to think about as they begin the process of going, how am I going to grow this business up?
Well, one is have a plan.
Right.
What I find a lot of times is that an owner hasn't thought about exit. And when I was a master facilitator and facilitator at the Kauffman Foundation, that was one of the first things we worked with entrepreneurs in, was defining the exit strategy, because all of the decisions that you make from the beginning of your business until that exit will in large part be determined by whatever your exit strategy is. And another would be, you know, being resolute about transitioning when business is good. I love the quote from Bill George. He was the CEO at Medtronic. He's now a business executive at Harvard. And he says, when times are tough, you can't leave. When times are better, you don't want to.
Right.
So leave when the timing is good. And if you leave when the timing is more natural, sometimes that's helpful from an emotional perspective, right? I gave the caveat of over control earlier.
Right.
And to let go is difficult. There's a grieving process associated with that. But sometimes if you can tie your exit, if it's an owner exit, if it's a leader exit, to maybe a major initiative that you've spearheaded or helped champion comes to a close, or maybe there's an acquisition, right, that would allow for just a more natural beginning or ending that can make it more palatable. And then start to identify and answer the question, what's next? What's next? The reason a lot of people don't exit, the reason a lot of people don't plan succession when or how they should, is they can't answer that question. So if you have a vision and if you have a plan that ties to your purpose, it can feel more like, hey, this was one season. This was one chapter of my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm simply just carrying that purpose in my backpack with me across to the next thing, right? And most exit, they're not stopping there, right? They're serial entrepreneurs. They're going to start something else. They'll rinse and repeat what they learned in that last pre-rapid to rapid growth transition and take that knowledge and that intellectual capital somewhere else. You know, I mentioned, I have to share this one thing. I mentioned purpose, having a purpose and a vision for what's next. I worked with a group of CEOs who are part of YPO, and I was connected to them through a CEO client of mine, and they were all at a transitory part in their lives and careers. And they said, you know, we need to crystallize our purpose. And I said, you know, you're right. So they they brought me in and we did some work. There's a process that I help put people through to achieve that and have that awakening, that aha moment. And one of the CEOs developed his purpose at that point, and it's impacting the lives of many. Mm. Well, long after he exits, he is going to continue to impacting the lives of many because that's his purpose. And purpose transcends, right, a role or a job.
Absolutely. Well, I think especially for those of us as we get older, the question to me is not so much retire, but what we've talked about in prior podcasts is to learn how to rewire as such and find a, I don't know that you have to go from AC to DC if electrical analogies make sense, but to your point, what's the purpose? What is your retirement trick, as Dan Sullivan says, and how can you rewire to be, you know, hopefully you don't even have to be a better version of yourself, just a different version of yourself. So what's next for Teresa Carey? Where do you see yourself going personally and professionally?
I've been having this conversation recently with my husband, with a couple of close friends. And when I attended my 40th class reunion, it's now been almost 2 years ago, I was just fascinated that the R word was the most frequently used word, and it wasn't reunion.
it's not a compliment.
It was the R word that you just referenced, Dave, which is retirement. And I couldn't relate to that. And, you know, I left there that evening thinking, is that it? Was that just this culmination or the seminal experience that's all you've worked for your whole life? And so as I've had these conversations, and at 60, you think a lot more about this, but my husband and my friends have told me, you know, most people have a job. Most have some milestones along the way, and one of those is retirement. They don't love their work the way you do. And so, Dave, I would just answer your question by saying, I don't have a job. I have a calling.
Absolutely.
This is not what I do. It's who I am. So it's what's next. and I'll continue to do this. I'm not saying I won't have some, you know, slight pivots potentially along the way, because I'm sensitive to market conditions and client needs, but my purpose will sustain me, and it will always be to liberate greatness, no matter what that next step is.
You know, to your point, I'm convinced now, if we want to, everybody can live to be 100. The medicine is there, our ability to understand our bodies, for us to have the type of nutrition, exercise regimen, whatever. I think we can live to be 100. So the question is, well, what are you going to do after the typical retirement age of 65 or whatever hits? Because you've got a lot of life yet to live, and a lot of purpose. I want to thank Teresa Carey for coming on. Thank you so much, Teresa. How can a CEO of a company seeking to undertake rapid growth, how can they reach out and find you and obtain more information about you and your services?
Sure. On our website, performancepoint.com. You can reach me at Teresa, without an H, T-E-R-E-S-A, at performancepoint.com.
Thank you. And when you do that, remember to ask for the lady from Yadkin County, North Carolina. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're in search of assistance, go to davesider.com and schedule a consultation. Also, make sure to subscribe to the show, rate it if you would, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, until next time, be safe. And I want you to know that this podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice, and it is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in the podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners should consult with an attorney on their distinct circumstances.